Welcome to the Science and Cocktails podcast.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting.
And now the machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within a group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
Am I true? Am I awake?
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes behind?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. All of us go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
This episode is about the pill.
The pill.
And this is not just any pill. It is the pill that made it possible for millions of women to control when to have children, and therefore gave the possibility for them to take education, get real jobs, and earn their own money. And nonetheless, it freed women's sexuality by making sex about pleasure and not about the fear of getting pregnant. The positive effects that birth control pills have had for women and for gender equality is enormous and cannot be empathized enough. But still, a lot of women have rather mixed feelings about the pill. Today, more than 100 million women worldwide are on the pill. And though it is a salvation, it's not without a price for many women who experience several side effects connected to its use. Some of them are quite obvious, like gain of weight or unwanted hair growth, but others are less visible and are not as easily connected to the use of the pill. This episode is not only about the pill, but also other kinds of hormonal contraception. During the last years, some new studies have come into light, indicated some quite important mental side effects, which are caused by the use of hormonal contraception.
For myself, I used the pill for more than 10 years before I quit it to get pregnant, and I was really shocked about how much it actually changed my personality.
This is Charlotte Skovlund, who made a huge population study where she, along with her supervisor Øyvind Lidegaard, looked for associations between the use of hormonal contraception, depression, and suicide rate.
I've been working with the Danish health registers for many years together with a gynecologist. One day I talked to a friend of mine who got an IUD, hormonal IUD, and she was very affected by it, and she was not sure if that could be the case, that it actually was the hormone ID that was affecting her, and not just because she had small children and life was hard.
How did it affect her?
She got stressed and she had difficulty sleeping. And she didn't really realize that it was the hormone ID. So I asked my professor in gynecology if this could be true, that you can be affected this way by the hormone ID. And he said, oh yes, 7 to 10% stop have it removed because they can't stand having it. And I was quite shocked because I thought that 7 to 10% is really a lot. When you get a hormonal IUD, you are not really informed that it can change how you feel. And because we both worked with this health registers, we got this idea that it could be very interesting to see if we could see a connection in the registers and see if we could see how many women is actually getting affected by the hormonal contraception on the psychological health.
Because Charlotte Skovlund had access to the Danish healthcare register, which includes data of the whole Danish population. The study is based on a very large data set.
We have 1 million women at the age of 15 to 34 that we follow for 6.3 years.
Okay, so that's quite a lot.
So it's quite a lot, yes.
Yeah.
So we have, of course, we then divided up to what kind of hormone contraception that they were using, so we could see if there was a difference, if the hormone ID was worse than the other, or if the mini pill that only contains progesterone, how that also affected the women. So, and we could then see if they later get a depression or use antidepressant medicine, had a suicide attempt or committed a suicide. And then we could compare these women with the women that was not using hormone contraception in the same age group.
And what did you find then?
We found that, unfortunately, every type of hormone contraception increased the risk of all the parameters, actually. But there was a difference between the products. So we can see that the normal pill, the pill that contains both progesterone and estrogen, and that was the most acceptable one. And then the mini pill was a bit higher risk, probably because it only contains progesterone that lowers the mood. And then we could see that the patch and vaginal ring, that is some new products, there we saw an even higher risk.
And you saw that all these products were associated with both depression and a higher suicide rate. And did you find a higher frequency of depression among formal users of the hormonal contraceptives too?
Yes, we actually found that the former users had a higher risk than the one that continued taking the hormonal contraception. So we actually saw this kind of selection that the women that continued taking their hormone contraception, they were the one that could tolerate it, and the one that stopped was the one that was more sensitive for hormones, and even that they have stopped, they will still many years after have an increased risk.
They found not only a higher risk of depression and suicide among users of all hormonal contraceptive products, but also among former users. The increased risk among former users might be associated with a sort of sensitivity to hormonal changes. And Charlotte Skovlund is not the only scientist within the field talking about a group of women being more sensitive to changes in hormone levels. And we'll get back to that. The population study Charlotte performed is based on statistics, and it therefore only shows an association between the use of hormonal contraception, depression, and suicide. But it does not tell how and why there is this association. And there's always a possibility that there could be something else that was not taken into concern, which can be causing a higher number of women getting depressed among the users of hormonal contraception.
What we saw in our study was that the timing of the depression event was very closely related to the start of hormone contraception. And therefore, we find it very likely that the start of hormone contraception is the reason. But of course, we cannot conclude that it is the reason. But we can say that it is very likely. And we don't really think that other parameters would have exactly the same timing. We see actually that already 2 to 3 months after starting hormone contraception, the risk increases up till after half a year. And when they have used hormone contraception in more than a year, the risk decreases again. So when you have used it more than a year, we have all the women that are more tolerant to this hormonal change, and they are left in our cohort.
Though the study does show a strong association, and the fact that the risk of depression is highest 2 to 3 months after the start of using a hormonal contraception does indicate a clear causality. But the study does not tell anything about why there is this causality. But the next scientist we'll meet has made a study which might do.
I'm Vibe Frokia. I'm an MD, PhD, and a clinical research associate professor. And currently I'm working at Neurobiology Research Unit here at the Copenhagen University Hospital, and also I'm a senior consultant in Mental Health Services Copenhagen.
Vibe Frokia has for a long time been doing research on how changes in hormonal levels can trigger depression in some women.
Yeah, so my interest came from register-based epidemiological evidence that there's a clearly increased risk for depressive episodes in phases of women's lives where natural ovarian hormones fluctuate, such as through puberty, from the pre- to postpartum state when women are pregnant and give birth, and also in the early phases of menopausal transition. So then hormonal contraception is a natural existing intervention, you might say, that manipulate the hormonal system. And that's why I think that it could be an important place to learn about these hormone-related contributions to depressive disorders. And also we know that starting an oral contraceptive triggers depressive episodes in some women.
Vibe Frøkjær had the rare opportunity to study how the use of the pill changes the brain function because she had access to a very large database on detailed images of brain scans.
So we have here built up over time a large database of very rare molecular brain images of important markers of the brain signaling system called the serotonin system in healthy volunteers. And I realized that for the time being, we had an opportunity to compare women who use oral contraceptives and are otherwise healthy, also mentally healthy, with women who do not use oral contraceptives. And I had the opportunity with the data available in the database to compare in specifically levels of a receptor, certain receptor for serotonin signaling called the 5-HT4 receptor. And it's important because the serotonergic system we know regulates many domains that are affected by depressive episodes, for instance, appetite, sleep, mood, irritability, capacity for coping with stress. And that's why we believe it's an important area that can be affected in a way that you can maybe be more prone to become depressed.
Okay. And what did the data show?
The data was actually a bit surprising to me because they showed quite a large difference in this receptor. Larger than we have seen in other studies.
She compared the oral contraceptive users with the non-users and looked at a specific serotonin receptor. Even though the difference in the serotonin receptor between the two groups was surprisingly large, it is necessary to make further studies to conclude that it is the use of the oral contraceptive that causes the change in this specific receptor. But the study does strongly indicate that the increased risk in depression when using the pill is related to the serotonin receptor. And it also makes sense because the serotonin system is related to our feelings of satisfaction and joy.
So I think it represents a very plausible link to why some women might experience depressive episodes when they start an oral contraceptive. So are there some subgroups that may, you know, have in particular sensitive to hormonal fluctuation?
But how do you know if you belong to this subgroup of women?
Yeah, so first we don't even know if we can talk about a coherent subgroup, because that should then generalize or translate to, you know, different types of hormonal transitions. But this is something that I'm gradually working on. But one could say that if you have reacted with a depressive episode coupled to when you started an oral contraceptive, this might be a sign that we can use, you know, just a patient history sign that we can use maybe to guide GPs that should monitor their patients, for instance, through pregnancy and postpartum, or even in perimenopausal states.
The subgroups again, which was also mentioned by Charlotte Skovlund. Some women might be more sensitive to hormonal fluctuations. And if you have a strong reaction, like depression, to the use of hormonal contraception, you might have a reaction to the hormonal fluctuations in the end of a pregnancy or after giving birth, or when you enter menopause. But unfortunately, it's not so easy to tell if you belong to this subgroup. But it might be in the future.
So we can see from some model work we've been doing, where we have manipulated with pharmacological intervention healthy women's hormonal level for a short period. And we can see that specific set of gene transcripts actually can predict which of these women develop subclinical, very light depressive-like symptoms. And from data mining, we can see that some of these gene transcripts actually points to a certain estrogen sensitivity. So it might be that if you're a hormone-sensitive person, your genome actually listens in another way to the hormonal signals. So it has more to do with how the genome reacts to a stimuli than it has to do with the absolute levels of hormones.
Hormonal contraception works by inducing artificial female sex hormones, progestin and estrogen. In the pill, it's both these two, and in the mini pills, in hormonal IUD, it's only progestin. Those are the hormones that control the menstrual cycle. When you get the artificial hormones from the contraception, your own production of these hormones are downregulated, and your natural menstrual cycle is out of the game, and that's why you can't get pregnant. But the artificial hormones does not only affect the natural production of the female sex hormones. Recently, a new study was released from Aarhus University showing that women using birth control pills have a general higher level of oxytocin, also known as the love hormone.
Well, my name is Michael Winterdale.
This is the man behind the study on a poor connection from Aarhus.
I'm a neuroscientist and I work in general on neuroimaging. But also in a broader sense with the neuroscience.
Oxytocin is known as a love hormone because it's released when we feel a good connection with other people. It is the hormone that makes us feel love, and it is very important for our social abilities.
Humans are not only social, we are super social. It's our superpower, so to speak. Imagine you have had a bad day at work and you come home. You don't have to say anything. Just your body language will make your boyfriend pick up on that. And it won't be long before he asks, well, what's wrong with you today? That is extraordinary. We are able to put ourselves in another person's place. We are able to understand another person's feelings. And that ability, that's mediated by oxytocin. So I was, from a biochemical point of view, I had reasons to think that sex hormones would interact with oxytocin. And the pill is just sex hormones. It's actually two sex hormones packaged in one pill. So I think I was fascinated by the idea if something so everyday-like as the pill would actually affect oxytocin and then affect our ability to be social.
For many years, oxytocin was associated with only women because it is the hormone that controls the whole act of giving birth and breastfeeding.
So the contractions of the uterus during labor is initiated by release of oxytocin. The milk letdown reflex is mediated by oxytocin. The feeling of attachment to the child is linked to oxytocin. And that's where it comes into play for all of us, because attachment is mediated by oxytocin. And that's actually my colleague and very, very good collaborator, Paul Sack. He didn't invent oxytocin, obviously. Oxytocin is a molecule that we all have in our body, but he put it into the social context that is important when we interact with other people and feel that special connection. That special connection, that's oxytocin being released.
Michael Winterdale and his colleagues included 185 young women from a college in California.
Well, it was actually surprisingly straightforward. They came into the lab, answered a lot of psychological questionnaires, and we asked them to give a little bit of blood, which we then could analyze for different hormones.
Was these women, were they all on the pill, or was it like 50-50?
No, that's the good part about doing it in the US. If we had done it in Denmark, over 90% of young women are actually on the pill in Denmark. So it would be very hard to have two groups, one that doesn't use the pill and one who does. But in the US, it's more 50-50. So our sample was more or less equal size users and non-users.
And what did these blood samples show?
Well, it showed that not only have women who use the pill higher levels of oxytocin in their blood, they have much higher levels of oxytocin in their blood.
Okay. Why do you think it is like that?
Well, it's a bit surprising because you would think oxytocin, that must be a good thing. We can discuss that in a moment, whether it's a good thing or not. From a biochemical point of view, I can understand why it's higher. Because in genes, there are something called promoters that tells you how often should a gene be transcripted to the actual molecule. And estradiol is actually a promoter or works on the promoter for oxytocin. So the hormones that are in the pill act on the transcription of oxytocin. So that's why the levels are so high.
Okay. So because there is this high level of those sex hormones from the pill, then they induce the...
Yes, exactly. So our physiology is... Let's use the word hijacked by these high level of hormones that you get from the pill.
Okay.
So that, at least that is what we think is going on.
Okay. And what does that mean for those women? What does it change the way they feel in general?
That's a very good question. So in all fairness, we didn't look that much on that aspect in the first paper that we have published. So that was just to establish hormone values. So we didn't look so much into the psychology. But you could think about what it means, or at least we're discussing it in the paper. So if you imagine that oxytocin has to be released very dynamically, So to have the feeling of connecting with another individual, that's a burst of oxytocin, it's a peak. But if you're always high, imagine it being a very large ocean, that then that peak just becomes a very small wavelet on that very big ocean. So maybe you're not able to feel that special connection as clearly as you would otherwise.
Okay. Couldn't it be that they would just generally feel more connected to everyone and just general more like social?
Well, you could think that, but the special part about oxytocin is it has to be released in these bursts. And I think that is where you can miss it. And there is also a literature saying that it's the positive effect in the women that's changed. So that we know that the emotional life is slightly different. Some describe it as blunted when you're on the pill. There isn't that much literature on it, but we do know that And it's also what I hear when people describe the feeling, slightly blunted emotional response. And especially the positive emotional response. And that would fit very well with a lot of the positive feelings are probably oxytocin mediated. Not the negative ones, that's a completely different story, but the positive one. We get a lot of reinforcement from being social and being in a group.
Okay.
So that is at least my concern when I see these data.
So the pill affects the levels of female sex hormones and oxytocin. But there is more. It also suppresses the stress hormone, cortisol.
This is something we have known for the last 20 years or so. It's one of the reasons that women are excluded from medical trials, because they do not have a normal stress response. But that's quite interesting by itself, I think. It doesn't mean that you're not able to feel anxious, but it does mean that the fight or flight response is different. And sometimes you need that. So if you go to an exam, it's a good thing to be very alert. It's a good thing to mobilize every cell in your body and being able to use that.
Does it mean that women on the pill are just generally less alert because they have this lower levels of those stress hormones?
Well, it's a good question. And I don't know completely what it all the behaviors that it changes. I think that's just something that's starting to emerge. But it's definitely worth studying further, I think.
So there's a lot of data showing that the pill can be a real mindfucker. By doubling the risk of suicide among young women and increasing the risk of depression, affecting the receptors related to joy and satisfaction, as well as the hormone oxytocin. And on the top of that, it has for a long time been known to decrease the level of cortisol, which makes us alert in stress situations. And it even decreases the level of testosterone related to sex drive. So what is even the point in all this suffering to have a free and safe sex life when even the drive for having sex is decreased? I asked Michael Winterdale if he thinks it's worth it taking the pill.
Yes, it is. The pill changed society completely. It liberated women. So the number of women that were able to go to university and have an education, that completely changed when the pill was free or accessible. So today that women have an education and they're not at home taking care of kids is basically due to the pill. So that's very important to recognize. So the pill is important. It's a safe way not to be pregnant, and it's important for family planning. But it probably means that is it okay to ask questions. Right now, there's a tendency to, at least in Denmark, that we just hand pills to every teenage girl that comes in to a GP's practice. And that's probably, I would like more research into that, what that means. And it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to say, well, this is right for you. Maybe this is not the right pill. There are several generations of pills. There are several brands of pills. So it's also okay to challenge a bit the GP on the prescription and ask questions.
Okay, but that might be difficult as a teenage girl being 15 years old and she didn't read the article you published or any other articles.
Yes, absolutely. So that is, and when is the brain most plastic? When does the brain change the most? That's obviously in the teenage years. So before you are maybe 25 or something like that. And that's when most women are on birth control. So I think we really need more research into what does that do to the brain. Is that effect of, I'm sure it's relatively safe when you're 25 and older, but how about the teenage years? How does this changed hormone levels affect rates of depression, for instance? So that's where we need the research, I think. And it's where the teenage girls probably need also the mothers to discuss this. And there might be a slight misconception on how hormonal contraceptives works. So even discussing this with your GP will sometimes result in some strange conversations. So there's when something is hormonal, it means it goes into the bloodstream and it affects the whole body. So it, pharmacologically, there's nothing that's local. It all goes into the bloodstream. So different parts of the body are affected. And that is where we need the research. So in that sense, I think women need to stand up for themselves and say, we need this.
And what do you think happened to the male pill?
I think if oral contraceptive for women were to be approved today, they would never have been approved. It's a question of history that they are around today. So the male pill is not going to be approved, or maybe it is. I think something is very close again now, but nonetheless, it has side effects, and obviously it has side effects. You tampering with the hormones of the body, and that's probably why it hasn't been approved by now. But women have side effects too. And that's just for the history that no one really looked that much into those.
Though the pill has indeed liberated women from unwanted pregnancies, and therefore it has been a keystone in the struggle for gender equality, but women trying to take control of their own reproduction did not begin with the pill. Cave paintings and ancient literature tells the story of how contraceptive methods were used thousands of years ago. In ancient Egypt, a paste of honey, acacia leaf, and lint was used to block sperm. And acacia leaves does have some spermicidal qualities and is used today in contraceptive jellies. Less effective might have been paste of honey, sodium carbonate, and crocodile dump, which was used for the same purpose. A wide spectrum of plants with contraceptive properties has been used by women all over the world. But many of them are highly toxic, so the women had to be very careful with taking the right dose. Slices of lemons has been used in the vagina to block sperm, and the acidity does have some spermicidal effects. But it couldn't have been very comfortable. Later, Coca-Cola has been used for the same purpose. And contraceptive methods used by men go way back as well. The Bible describes the use of coitus interruptus, also known as the withdrawal method, or pull out and pray, which was used by a man who spilled his sperm on the floor to avoid making his deceased brother's wife pregnant, though God did kill him for that. Evidence of the use of condoms made of silk and animal intestines is found in cave paintings and literature from all times. But many religions did not approve to the use of contraceptive methods, and the distribution of knowledge about contraception has been suppressed, and the distributors have been arrested or even burned as witches, who were also known to advise women about contraception. Books have been destroyed, and teaching about contraception has been illegal and still is in some countries. The pill has played a major role in liberating women. But the times has changed, and today other methods are available.
For example, there's the condom That is a very good option, especially for the young women, because it also protects against other diseases, sexually admitted diseases. And then there's the copper IUD that is also hormone-free, and you actually today you don't need to wait till you had your first born child to get it. You can get one that is smaller, so you can also use it if you have not had any children. And normally the reason why the doctors don't give them is because that you will have more bleeding, but that is normally only in the first couple of months, and then it would be more stable. So if you don't have problems with bleeding, I think that is a very secure and good method to use. And then there's of course also diaphragm, that is really old 60 protection, but you can also get it today.
Why is that not so popular?
Yeah, actually, I don't really think that a lot of women consider the option because it is a bit old, and maybe therefore not so popular. But maybe it will get like trendy again, something from the 60s.
Like a retro...
retro-trended, yeah.
Trended contraceptives.
But there's also, for the older population, I think that we should realize that sterilization is also an option. And especially for men, it is a very small operation. So... I would like to see that as a more used option, so you don't have to, so the women don't have to take hormones. I think we have tried to find hormone contraception for men, and it failed because they also get affected at their psychological health. So I don't think that is the way to go. We need to find something better than these hormones.
Though there are other possibilities, the pill might still be the best solution for some. But it is important that doctors give the women the right knowledge so that women can make an informed choice. One of the things that has been interesting about making this episode about the pill and other kinds of hormonal contraception is that we all have our stories. Almost all women in Denmark have for years been using hormonal contraceptives. And for a lot of us, it's like choosing one of two evils. Of course, we want to avoid unwanted pregnancies, but hormonal contraceptives changes our natural hormones. Not only when having sex, but at all times, day and night. And a lot of us have experienced how it has changed our mood, our life quality, and even our personality. I started using the pill when I was 15, because it was cheaper than the condoms. When you're a teenager in a relationship, you tend to use a lot of condoms. And I just could not afford it out of my pocket money. So I found out that the pills were much cheaper. But they had a strong effect on my mood. And for a time I was afraid that I had some kind of depressive disorder. Only after I stopped taking the pills did I start to feel better. I know that a lot of women feel just fine on hormonal contraception, but my hope is that young women will get better and more informed advice than I did. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Science and Cocktails podcast, which is funded by the Novo Nordisk Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort, for the Science and Cocktails Foundation. The music is originally composed by Hjelte Bisted Møller and me, also known as Trumler Orkestret.